This is File 88. This is Jean McMillan. I am interviewing Walter DeMille, who was director of the Edsel Ford Library at Hotchkiss School for 41 years. Today's date is December 11th, 2014. What is your name?
Walter DeMille.
And where were you born?
I was born in, I was actually born physically in Framingham, Massachusetts. My parents' time, my address really, or my birth, where I grew up, was in Natick, Massachusetts.
And your birth date?
June 3rd, 1943.
And your parents' names?
My father is Walter DeMille. My mother is Lucille. Her maiden name is Knott, K-N-O-T-T.
And do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older brother, Arthur, who's now deceased, and a younger sister, Susan, whose married name is Kerisy.
How do you spell that one?
K-E-R-R-I-S-S-E-Y.
K-E-R-R-I-S-S-E-Y. Thank you.
Sure.
Your educational background, briefly.
I'm a graduate of the Natick public school system, including Natick High School in 1961. I attended and graduated from Hobart College in Geneva, New York, with a major in English, and graduated in 1965. I have a graduate degree in library science from Rutgers, which is the State University of New Jersey, and that graduate degree date is 1970.
Now, you came to this area via Hawaii.
I did.
Tell me about the Hawaiian experience and the Salisbury Chaplain, please.
When I was graduating from college, I had intended throughout college actually had a scholarship that wasn't binding, of course, I was studying or wanted to study to be an Episcopal priest. And because of that, I worked in camps, and it happened to be an Episcopal camp during the summers in Buzzards Bay, Massachusetts, called Camp Denon.
And how do you spell that one?
D-E-N-N-A-N. And when I became a senior in college, I made the decision I did not want to pursue the priesthood. And this was 1965. Any able-bodied male who didn't have a job or in graduate school at that point, 6 weeks after college, could be expected to get a letter from Uncle Sam saying, "We want you." That was not something that I had any interest in. So during my senior year, the opportunity came, and I had been advised by friends and my college advisors and so forth, that since I already had a considerable amount of experience working with teenagers, and I had quite some success in my studies of English literature, that perhaps teaching would be a vocation for me. So I said, okay, how do I do that? I didn't have any courses in education. And they told me about private schools, where I wouldn't be required to have courses in education in order to be a teacher. As I said, I'm a public school graduate. I knew the names of some private schools, but I didn't really know anything about them. It happened that the headmaster of Hawaii Preparatory Academy visited the mainland once a year, and while he was visiting the mainland, he would visit the colleges where his graduates were attending, and he had students at Hobart College. And so he came, and when he would visit a college, he always offered the opportunity to interview with him for a possible opening. Even if he didn't have an opening, he would conduct the interviews because he wouldn't be able to interview people in person except during this one trip he made every year. So I signed up to have an interview with him because it would be a good experience for me to have that kind of an interview. I'd also learn something about what this was all about, private schools and so forth. And I did. At the time, he had no openings for which I would be qualified or which would interest me. But it was a good experience. And because of that, I also then enrolled with an agency that placed graduates in teaching positions, not necessarily just private school, but private school as well as public. And long story short, eventually I had two job offers from schools in Massachusetts, private schools. And I also got a letter from the headmaster of the school in Hawaii saying the situation had changed, and he did have an opening in English, and would I be interested in being a candidate for that? And I made the decision that, of course, why wouldn't I go to Hawaii instead of staying in Massachusetts where I had grown up? And I went to Hawaii. I was given the job, offered the job. I took the job, went to Hawaii, and I loved it. I loved everything about it. I loved the school. It was a relatively young school, but clearly in growing and being in its significance and its importance in the islands.
Which island was it on?
It was on the Big Island of Hawaii. That was one of its attractions. It was a boarding school. It had a day student population, and a significant number of the day students were girls, so that it had some... I had always co-ed classes, but not very many girls, because they were not as many as the boarding population. The boarders were all boys. And anyway, I went. I loved it. I loved teaching. I loved being in Hawaii. It was a very beautiful place. It was a very rural place. The community in which I was living, in which the school was based, I was living on campus, but the school community was a ranch town. It was a kind of the old feudal system. Parker Ranch, one of the largest ranches in the country, was the primary employer, and they housed almost all of their cowboys in houses in the village, they were primarily Japanese. So this town of Kanaloa, Hawaii, was primarily a Japanese cowboy town.
And how do you spell the name of the town?
Kamuela.
I can't go that fast.
Kamuela. Okay. Samuel, with Kamuela. So anyway, I had a tremendous experience there. And one of the things, because it was a small school, because it was a fairly new school, because there was a fair amount of turnover on the faculty every year because of its location and so forth. In my second year, I was given administrative duties as the title was principal, but essentially it was the dean for the 7th and 8th grade. I taught a Bible class to the 7th and 8th grade, but my primary teaching responsibilities were in the high school. And the students... so I had these administrative duties as a dean, and I really enjoyed that as well. I also, as one of my duties, worked in the library one night a week and became quite good friends, and to this day I'm still best friends with the man who was the director of the library. All of this is important background because what happened was going into my fourth year, or during the third year, I became engaged to be married to a woman whom I'd known since the fifth grade in Natick, Massachusetts. And we dated off and on over the years, sometimes very seriously with great deep commitment, and sometimes we drifted apart, but... we both came together at the same time, at the same moment, and became engaged and married. And Susan, who had been living in Washington, D.C., and teaching in the Montgomery County school system, one of the best in the country, agreed to come to Hawaii to live, essentially for 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the honeymoon year. And it was a wonderful experience. But as much as I loved it and loved being there, and as much as she came to love it, we realized that we were 6,000 miles away from our families, who lived 1 mile apart in Natick, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And that we, as we were, you know, looking forward to having children and so forth, we just didn't feel it was practical to think that we would be comfortable or want to live that far away from our families. And so I started thinking about what I would do. And I loved the administration. I loved the teaching. But I couldn't see myself look to a career of 40-some years as a classroom teacher. I just didn't think that would be enough for me. As much as I loved every bit of it, I really also enjoyed the administrative things. So what career or what path could I take that would combine the teaching, the scholarly, the working closely with kids, and the administrative? And my friend the librarian suggested I consider going to graduate school in library science. And I did some research and decided that that was indeed quite an attractive option. And also at the time, by the way, it was one that seemed to have tremendous job opening opportunities. There wouldn't be any employment issues. We decided that we would do it in a concentrated program, though, of 16 months, essentially, rather than my trying to do it part-time. And so we would depend upon Susan's teaching for the year, and I would be going, with 2 summers in the year, I would be going to graduate school, which is what we did. We got to the point of, now what, as we're getting to the end of graduate school. And I had entered the program thinking that I would do something not in education and librarianship. But by the time I got to the end of the program, I had become very much influenced by a woman, a professor, who was a young adult librarian at the New York Public Library. And that influence on working with young adults and her inspiration really encouraged me to return to something I knew well, which was working with adolescents and combining that with the librarianship and with private schools. And that's where I had my experience by then, and I had come to understand and love the environment and everything that they stood for. So I had then put my, started looking for jobs, and going back to Camp Denon, the Episcopal Boys Camp that I worked at during my every summer in college, the chaplain, the man who was assistant camp director, was also the chaplain at Salisbury School in Salisbury, Connecticut.
And what was his name?
His name is Robert Cain, C-A-I-N. And Bob and I kept in touch over the years, and when he became aware of my interests, he wrote to say that Salisbury would be looking for someone to be a part-time English teacher, part-time librarian.
Perfect.
And that seemed to fit quite well. And so I started inquiring about that opening. And at the same time, through the placement office at the university, I found that there was an opening for a full-time library director at another private school near Salisbury called the Hotchkiss School. So I made arrangements to interview for both on the same trip. And I did. And eventually I was offered both jobs. By that time, I decided that the better job for me at that point in my life was the full-time job, because I had essentially given up on the idea of becoming a classroom teacher, and so I didn't see any reason to do that, and to be a part-time librarian wasn't going to fulfill what I had been preparing for and what I had been studying for and what I thought my next steps were. So we took the job at Hotchkiss, and that was in 1970, and came here with the intention of staying for 4 or 5 years to get a good solid background and, you know, something strong for my resume. And
then you stayed 41 years.
For there, and we're now, 44 years later, we're still here in Salisbury.
And we're lucky to have you.
Yeah, well, thank you. But it was a wonderful decision, and it was a great choice, and it was the right choice for us.
And it couldn't have been better. Yeah. Just couldn't have been better.
Yeah.
Now, you said before that you were the first professional librarian that Hotchkiss had.
Well, I want to correct that. When the Edsel Ford Library was built in about 1954-55, the headmaster, George Van Sanford, hired a professional librarian named Mary Zelia Philippides.
Oh, gosh. You want to try to spell that one?
It's Philip, E-D-E-S. Mary Zelia Philippides.
I'm not going to go for the Zelia, it's just going to be Z. Okay.
And she was hired to essentially start the library as it was being built and as it was just opening. And she was there for 5 years. And when she left, she and her husband left and went to Greece. When she left, her successor was a person on the staff who had no library background other than a couple years working under the direction of Mary Zelia. Mm-hmm. And so there was a 19-year gap between the time Mary Zelia left and the time I came. And so in that regard, there was a long hiatus between professional librarians and people trained for it as a profession and trained in working with adolescents and developing library programs and so forth.
Now, what did the Edsel Ford Library look like when you came?
If you're familiar with the current building...
I'm slightly familiar with it.
It was the second floor of the current building. The central part of the second floor of the current building. It was a very traditional, almost gentleman's reading club library. Beautiful white oak paneled walls, gorgeous high arc ceiling, and a series of alcoves along each side. Very formal, and it was, as I said, on the second floor, mm-hmm. and below it in the building were classrooms. So you entered it by going up a grand staircase of terrazzo marble, mm-hmm. To get into the library. And the bones of the original library is still intact.
But the staircase is now carpeted.
It's now occupies 24,000 square feet. The original building that I became, that existed when I came was 4,000 square feet. The original library part of the building was 4,000 square feet. So during my career, through the various renovations and expansions, in particular one major one, we increased its size by 6 times. So there's a great deal about it that is quite different than anything that existed.
When you came there, what did you have for staff? Did you have a staff?
There was a staff, which I inherited. There were two part-time people, a typist, who I think worked about 15, 16 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And there was another person, Ann Bowen, who still lives in town here, who worked part-time. And probably again about 15 or 18 hours a week. And then there was one person who worked full-time as an assistant, as a staff member. And by full-time, I mean, 40-hour week days.
Now, when you left, mm-hmm. How many renovations or refurbishments had been to the library, and how had your staff increased?
Well, as I said, we increased the size of the library by six, six times. There was a kind of a preliminary. As soon as I started working at Hotchkiss, they were already beginning to plan some kind of refurbishment of the building because they had received a gift from Henry Ford of about $200,000 to refurbish the library. And the intention of the library committee, which was made up of senior faculty members, was essentially to spruce it up. There was no major change going to take place, but they were going to do some interior design and interior decorating and refurbish paint and furniture and so forth. I started then thinking along quite different paths in terms of how a modern library in a school setting like this might be arranged rather than the formal English reading room, men's, gentlemen's reading room style.
Something more practical.
And something more user-friendly. But at that same time, early 70s, was the time, first of all, when there was an economic downfall in the country, and secondly, it was also the time when, during that time, 72, 73, when the school made the decision to become a co-ed school.
Oh, yes.
And so, obviously, most of everyone's attention, even though we were working with an architect on plans for a new library, actually, the direction we were going was not to stay in the current location, but to go to a new facility. But the emphasis and the priorities became preparing for co-education and doing what needed to be done in terms of facilities to prepare for a co-ed environment. And so, the dormitories, the gymnasium, the athletic facilities, and so forth, they leapt to the top of
leapt
the list.
To the fore.
And we did succeed in getting some space soon after co-education. It became quite clear that in a co-ed school, the library is a very important place because it's a place where it's appropriate for boys and girls to be together, to hang out together, to work together, to study together. And it's a safe place in the sense that you could go there and not appear to be, going with anyone or anything like that. It was just a very comfortable place. And our population soared in terms of use, and by then I also had gotten the administration to agree that the library would only be open if there were library staff members there. And we were open, we changed our hours, so we were then open 80 hours a week, part of every day, and that just made it a much busier place and a place that needed more space. And so by 1980, we had gotten permission and secured the money to do a temporary expansion of the building by taking over the classroom floor and tearing down those walls and introducing carpet. Including on the stairway, because
you had a good story about that one.
One of the things that was happening in fashion those days were girls were wearing clogs, and they would go up those marble stairs in their clogs, and of course that was a tremendous noise intrusion, and something that got everyone's attention. So it did not take much of an argument to get everyone on board with carpeting. But it also softened the space and made it warmer and more inviting. And we introduced comfortable furniture and a number of things to make it a more comfortable, attractive space that people would want to come to and just be, just hang out, just read or study or not, just have a nap. One of the things I tried very hard to do was to make the library a place where people felt comfortable for whatever reason. As long as they stayed within the limits of appropriate behavior, then
But it was a place they wanted to be.
Exactly, exactly. And it was, it served that role very well.
You were very successful in that.
Yes.
Very successful.
Yeah. And you asked about other renovations. So just, we continued on working with the architect, whose name is Evans Wollen, W-O-L-L-E-N, who was a graduate of Hotchkiss and Indianapolis-based. And we worked with him for almost 10 years on refining plans. And by then, I had said we were originally planning on a new facility or a different location. Mm-hmm. By then, I really had become quite fond of the space, mm-hmm. and particularly felt that it was in the best possible location because it was
quite
on the
central.
Way to the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one thing a library doesn't want to be in, that's a destination or an endpoint. You want to be on the way to someplace important. So it's an easy drop-in place. It's a place where everyone's comfortable, and it's just a very natural thing to stop by. And we didn't. And being near the dining room, of course, meant everyone went by the library three times a day.
Sure.
And that obviously attracted a significant population. Increase in population. So we did another sort of temporary redo of furnishings and so forth, but then the major renovation of the building, complete renovation and expansion took place completed in 1982. So it took a decade essentially from the time I started to the time we finished. Fulfilling our goals, but we got permission to stay in the location and expand in that location, and it was a wonderful. It is a wonderful.
It's a wonderful spot. It certainly is.
Yeah.
Now your staff must have increased too.
Yes, the staff did increase significantly. As I said, we because of the multi-level facility, we needed at least two people on duty whenever the library was open. In the evenings, on weekends, and so forth. And so, in addition to the practicality of having people who are dependent upon each other for their work and for the workflow, we would have four or five people in the library during the workday. We would always have to have two other people, two additional people, or two people at night. So that demanded additional staff. We knew that going into planning a multi-level facility. The existing library has three major levels and three stories and five levels. So there are two floors that have two levels. And the elevator stops at all levels, and so therefore it's a user-friendly, physically handicapped-friendly space. It's as if it's a one-floor space because of the elevator.
I was in it recently because I was asked to observe the cemetery project that the Humanities Department does.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting, particularly for me, going up the staircase because of the story that you told me.
Right.
And I have been in it on occasion, but this was the first time that I was on the premises in a function that was related to Hotchkiss. And
right.
It was very well laid out. And the people knew what they were doing, and the staff was always helpful. So
it
does make it a very comfortable place to be and not intimidating.
Right. We had, ultimately, when I left, when I retired, I think we had the equivalent of close to seven full-time employees on the staff. Now, that breaks down pretty quickly to matter of fact, it might even be eight, more than that. It might have been eight, because there were a number of part-time people, and so there would be more bodies than the eight, but the full-time equivalency would be that. We went from one professional to four during my career, first of all, the changes in the profession,
mm-hmm.
and
oh,
secondly,
yes.
the expansion of the program the emphasis we put on instruction and service and all the things that we do, the staff increased appropriately.
Now, I think you told me that you were interested in library architecture and you ran a consulting business. Mm-hmm. Would you tell me about that,
consulted
place?
On. Yeah, I became very interested, actually, while I was in graduate school, on place, the library as place, and how the place informs behavior and how it influences how people use the building and how it can detract from how people use a building and a place, how spaces are really significant. And I did a study about of a school library in Princeton, New Jersey. His name escapes me right now. But as part of my master's thesis. And I became really interested. And so I started doing some reading and obviously the 10 years working with Evans Woolen was important. I went and visited a large number of libraries of all types, not just private school libraries. Mm-hmm. I became very interested in what I was seeing and changes. A lot of changes were going on in terms of library architecture and how spaces were being created and what was needed and the various emphases that was being placed on different aspects of it. And after my experience, I started getting calls from a few schools asking me if I would, you know, come talk to them about my experience or come help them make decisions and so forth. And that did turn into consulting business is probably too strong a word. I was a consultant over that probably 25-year period to about... Well, more than 30 private school libraries.
Were you consulted at all when Sarah Wardell did the renovation with this building?
No.
Okay.
No. I was a consultant on the Salisbury School Library and worked very closely with them and their architect on that project. And of those 30 different projects, I would do different things. Sometimes it would be a 1 or 2 day visit, and I'd respond to plans or whatever. Sometimes it was, in some cases, it was a 4 or 5 year association, as certain things, delayed projects, or as they started off thinking they were going to, paint and polish, and they wound up building a whole new building in a location.
It's like getting a new stove and renovating the entire kitchen.
Once you start asking questions and people start thinking more closely about it and examining it. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks they know what a library is, but libraries are pretty unique characters, and they really respond to the needs of the individual client, whether it's a school or a community or whatever. And they really they have a lot in common. They also have a lot of difference, and it's important to get to what that difference might be or what it should be. And that was the fun part of it, and
sure.
And it was also a very awakening experience for a lot of committees that I worked with. One of the things I always insisted on doing is that they always had to go on a field trip, preferably with me, but if not, on their own, and visit at least 3 other libraries, and then go and visit their own library. With the same questions, the same eyes, the same attitude, but informed and given the vocabulary of their experience of the other libraries. So they've been to another library and seen certain things or asked questions and found out why they were doing certain things, and then they go back to their own library and see it quite differently.
Certainly.
And it also gave everyone a safe... you could have a conversation and not be threatening. To others, or to make people feel defensive. Oh, wait a minute, we do that, or wait a minute, we can do that, or we've got this sort of thing or that sort of thing. But you can talk. Your vocabulary is expanded, and you're now talking about other examples, not just your own space. And it's a very powerful tool.
It would be. It's empowering.
Yeah. So altogether, in terms of complete new facilities or major renovations, I think there were 11 of those 30.
Oh my!
That were significantly, major works. And I'm very proud of that.
Well, you should be.
And it's an
achievement.
And great fun. Obviously, I had to be careful and be very. I had a full-time job. I had an obligation to my own school, but. just as a classroom teacher or a subject specialist would be invited to, give a lecture or run a seminar or something like that. I was in the position and always had the support of the administration to do what I was doing.
You couldn't have done it if you hadn't had the support.
No, right.
And it kept you fresh.
Oh, absolutely.
And
sure.
that's important, too. That's very important.
I learned a great deal from that.
No, that's what your profession should do.
Right, exactly.
Now, you did all sorts of changes. I know the one that sticks in my mind is the filing system that you created, which is very different.
Shelving.
Yes.
Shelving of the collection. Yeah, one of the principles on which I worked was the library lingo is access. Access is a very important principle in libraries, and access can be defined, and you can use it covering all kinds of things. Access to the library itself, expanding the hours. I told you the story of taking away the keys and changing the locks. When I got there, I found out that there were probably 6 or 7 masters who had keys to the library, but the library was closed at the dinner hour and didn't open again. Well, sometimes it opened in the evening run by students, which was not necessarily what I would call a library, but it was often closed on weekends and other times. But these people who had the keys could go in any time.
Yeah.
And my belief was that the library should be open to everyone whenever it was open. That everyone should have, in a sense, equal access to it. That we had an obligation to provide access to any kind of information, any kind of resource that people wanted. And in that regard, one of the things that I did, which among my colleagues throughout the country is considered somewhat controversial, but we shelved all the materials in one cataloging system. We happen to be using the Dewey Decimal System. So that regardless of what type of material it was, it all sat together in their Dewey number. For example, if you take a Shakespearean play, Romeo and Juliet, we would have text copies, of course, of a number of different editions of the play. We might have criticism about the play. That would also be shelved there. There might be video or DVD performances of the play.
Oh.
They would be shelved there. There might be recordings of people, just simply recordings of the play, not visual, but just audio.
Mm-hmm.
They would be shelved there. So everything that had anything to do with Romeo and Juliet would be shelved together.
So you didn't have to go searching all over the library.
You didn't have to go searching to different parts of the library. Particularly, a lot of people didn't like it because they liked keeping materials of the same sort together, like
mm-hmm.
DVDs
yeah.
all together or audio recordings all together. I didn't feel that the material type trumped the content. To me, the content was the most important thing. The other thing that I knew, just by my career and working with kids, is that kids aren't going to go through too many hoops to get to what they want. They'll get to the first thing first, and that would pretty much be it. So I wanted them to have the option of finding whatever it was that they were looking for
in
one location.
And then they'd be more apt
to pick it up.
And
it's also the great browsing power of browsing in an open collection. How difficult it is in a closed collection where you have to ask for everything. You don't get a chance to browse the shelves and so forth. And this integrated collection is what I called it, and is what it is called. That combining all these materials of different types made it much easier for people to browse and to find things that they weren't necessarily looking for. They didn't know they were looking for it, but there it is.
Yeah.
And there's a recording, or they might only know of a particular version of Romeo and Juliet, but then they see 2 or 3 other versions of it in DVD and might be attracted to taking or trying one of those. So is one of the, fits into the principle of providing access to materials of all types. It also happened to, in my opinion, be consistent with Howard Gardner's philosophy of multiple intelligences, where you know people learn differently
mm-hmm.
with different kinds of materials, and sometimes people are visual learners, sometimes they're audio learners, sometimes they're print oriented, mm-hmm. And so if all of that's there, then you're not segregating or discriminating against the
different types of learners. Wonderful. You expanded the reference index considerably.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, that's because that's again the access thing. When I came to the Ford Library, and actually I think probably an argument could be made for it to still be kind of the largest research library in the area, the largest library that has as a focus research. But the library only had periodical indexes, Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, is an old standby. People don't know mm-hmm. it now, but it used to be the only way you could get things, or the index of the New York Times. We only had the editions that started when the library was started, and Mrs. Philippides began collecting in anticipation of the actual building. So I think the earliest date of any of our indexes was 1952. So if you were doing any research that had anything to do with anything before that, you didn't have the tools.
Mm-hmm.
And an index tells you that something exists. And so rather than put my focus initially on expanding the collection of materials, I felt that the first place we should expand was the collection of indexes and bibliographies.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we could give people the tools to find out that something existed, some scholarly work, some book of criticism, some article on a particular thing, or a series of articles on a particular subject, if they could find out that it existed, then our job would be to get it for them and bring it to them. So that was why we chose to put the emphasis on that. And I sought significant money from the trustees early on to do that and to expand the indexes and was given that resource. I was always supported tremendously by the trustees, and if they could, they would. And that was an important resource.
All probability, having talked with you previously, you put forth a very good case for
mm-hmm.
what you wanted,
right.
And it was reasonable,
mm-hmm.
and they were reasonable people.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
sure.
It
was enhancing the scholarship of the institution, and of course, large number of faculty members were very appreciative. And as we expanded our research capacity, of course, people became more and more able to pursue their own studies. So one of the things we always tried to do was provide support to teachers who were pursuing doctoral degrees or anything like that. We basically, our philosophy is if you want to come ask it, ask us for it and we'll get it for you. And we had a very high percentage of success with that because it's relatively easy if you know the tricks or if you're indefatigable.
Yeah.
If you don't say no, if you don't give up.
Keep trying.
Yeah, exactly. And we came, I had a wonderful staff member at that point who had an incredible memory. I mean, she could remember this year, that last year the teacher asked for something, or another teacher asked for exactly the same article, and she remembered where she had gotten it. She just had a phenomenal memory. And was, as I said, indefatigable. She just would not say no. Track down whatever someone wanted, and had great success with it. Obviously, you learn quickly. You can depend upon certain libraries, like Trinity College or Williams or some of the smaller libraries. You don't ask Harvard University for everything because, first of all, they wouldn't participate in interlibrary loan because that would be too easy for everyone. They'd just always go to Harvard or Yale or something like that.
Yeah.
So we learned and developed strong relationships by being good borrowers. Interlibrary loan was a significant part of our program.
And explain what that is, please.
It's a library borrowing from another library, essentially. It's a library borrowing, not the patron, but
mm-hmm.
the library is borrowing. And then in our case, we would borrow something. We usually given access to it for a certain period of time, usually 3 or 4 weeks. And we would house it in the library, and then the students would have to come and use it in the library. That way we knew that we had sort of certain control.
You had to have control.
We knew where it was and so forth. Faculty members, we would let take the materials, but the students, we just really felt that we were open enough that if they needed it, they could, and would. And occasionally we would let them take it out overnight, but they'd have to have it back the next morning and that kind of thing. So we tried to be as user-friendly as possible, but you have to also develop
certain,
and because you want to be good borrowers, exactly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're borrowing something from someone else, you want to make sure that you return it.
In as good condition, if not better.
Right.
How did you manage to balance the needs of the school with opening it up to the community as far as using the library?
Well, here we are back to access. Mm-hmm. When I came, I began noticing that there were a few people from the community who came to the library. Usually they were writers. Sometimes they were, I guess in almost all cases they were writers. And I thought that was wonderful. You know, we had, I had all these goodies and people were using them.
Mm-hmm.
And I began thinking, just as I had with the keys and everything else, that, well, how do I know that all the people who want to use this or could use this or need access to this know that we're here? And so I talked with the staff and convinced them that it would be appropriate for us to essentially be open to the public and encourage the public to come, mm-hmm. not advertise it.
No.
We didn't want to, and certainly the public libraries knew that we adopted this posture.
Mm-hmm.
And they sometimes were, would refer people to us. If they knew that people had certain interests in a certain subject, they couldn't possibly have the depth that we might have if we were teaching it or if it was an area where we had a huge collection. I mean, we had, I think it was 7,000 or 8,000 art books.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a public library of 25,000, you couldn't possibly have that kind of depth or breadth. And so the art collection was one, for instance, that was very popular. We had, adopt a policy. We had some regulations about it. We had, told people that if one of our own students or faculty members needed something, then we would call them and expect them to return it as soon as possible. Everyone thinks that's going to happen all the time. It doesn't.
Really?
I can't imagine that it would happen more than a few dozen times in my 40 years that we had to call someone and say, we really would like this back because we need it for one of our students or one of our courses or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was really did not happen. And we would loan, at one point, 17% of our circulation was to the community.
Oh, how wonderful.
It was a significant
amount.
The other part of it, from a management point of view or from the director's point of view, the other thing that was really wonderful about it was that having those adults in the library was a tremendous example and learning experience for our students. And it also was a behavior modification.
Oh, yes.
There are other adults here.
Yeah.
There are other people here.
And they're not known elements like a faculty member?
Right. But it was more significantly, it was, learning is lifelong.
Mm-hmm.
And
it should be.
And people of all ages, and particularly it would be adults, sometimes it was students from other schools,
mm-hmm.
but the ones who were noticed were the adults who were there studying or working very diligently
mm-hmm.
on theses or whatever, and that was a good example for our students.
It would be.
It was something that we really cherished. And we had very little problem with it. Every once in a while, we would have someone who was not, who didn't really honor the experience. And I would have to speak to them and ask them either to change their behavior or to not
mm-hmm.
consider coming. But that
it was rare.
Extremely rare. I think it probably didn't happen three or four times.
That's a good average.
Truly.
That's a good average.
Whether or not you can continue to do that in this world, in this day and age, I don't know. But our hope seems to be more difficult, but
hope springs eternal.
Right, exactly. Well, I certainly hope that it's a possibility that can be sustained, because it's really a great benefit and value. And I know. I meet people. I met someone yesterday who knew of me or knew me because of the fact that many years ago, when he was actively involved in his profession, he would use the library for certain things, and he really valued it and valued that experience. And for people who had taken graduate courses in New Haven or something like that, they could come and use a lot of our materials first, and then just save themselves a trip, or then go to the unique materials that their university held. And because we had, by then we had all of the New York Times on microfilm, we'd have significant resources and bibliographies and books in the collection, or other materials in the collection that would be used and useful to them.
How about the Kineticar and kinetic card system? Did that work as well as you'd hoped?
No. The answer is no.
Okay. Can you explain?
I was part of the initiative. It was called Project 76, and obviously in the early 70s. It was a statewide initiative and study groups, and I was part of those study groups. It was planning statewide library service, and out of that at the time grew six regional districts. The state was divided into six regions, and a number of initiatives were begun to help facilitate library use. One of them was Kinetic Card, which still exists, mostly still exist. The Kinetic Card means that you can use your public library card in any other public library in the state. And obviously that's a tremendous benefit and a tremendous resource for people. That if you're in Sharon, you can go into the library, but if you're not going back to Sharon, you can return the book in Fallsburg. Or if you're in Farmington and need something in that library that you don't have here, then you could take it out there, and that kind of thing. So Kinetic Car was a delivery system that went between libraries. And what I tried to get them to consider, and had several discussions over the years with several different state librarians, was that the Kinetic Car that was going from Salisbury to Sharon was going right by the Edsel Ford Library, and couldn't it stop there and pick up or deliver books that people wanted on interlibrary loan? And it was never anything that we were able to successfully get in the books. So the car would go by us. And if Salisbury had a number of things that they wanted to borrow from us, we'd have to either find someone who was coming to town and have them deliver it, or we'd actually literally package it and mail it.
Oh, dear.
Which was a tremendous, first of all, time waste.
Oh, sure.
But secondly, expense.
Sure.
But that was the only way we could do it. We couldn't use the Kinetic Card system. So it didn't make any sense. The Kinetic Card, of course, we went around that ourselves just simply by allowing people to come in and borrow things as long as we had some kind of valid ID. Knew that they lived somewhere nearby.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what is the Edgar M. Cullman Chair?
It's an honorary chair, like an endowed chair, created. Hotchkiss has a number of them, and a number of them were created at the time of the centennial in 1990-something. I can't remember now exactly when it was. Probably 95 or 6, but at any rate, that chair is given to a teacher, a master teacher, essentially, in recognition of their talent.
You received one.
And I was the first recipient of that particular chair. Edgar Cullman was a longtime member of the Board of Trustees and a longtime president of the Board of Trustees, and it was a chair endowed by his brother or brothers to honor him. And I was very fortunate because
You earned it.
Well, thank you. But one of the things that I always tried to help my colleagues understand by example primarily, but sometimes by argument, was that I was a teacher. Mm-hmm. That a librarian is a teacher. Mm-hmm. And that the library was my classroom as well as my athletic field. And it was in that space that I worked with and taught students and faculty members and other users of the library, just as they would in the classroom setting. And so that recognition of the role of the librarian of the as teacher was a very important one, and I was very honored to have made that case so that I was given that chair. So, and it was something I held throughout the rest of my career.
When did you retire from Hotchkiss?
2011.
Is there anything that I haven't covered about your career as the director of the library?
No, not specifically as the director of the library, other than as the director of the library and as me. I served in a number of other capacities at the school, on a number of committees, and I chaired significant number of committees. In a boarding school environment, the faculty members
do more than one thing.
Do a great deal. Mm-hmm. And working with students, I always advised students. I had my own advisees. Became very close with them. I don't think there's anything else. I had written down a few notes just to make sure that I didn't forget a couple things.
Oh, good.
I think we've covered it. Our job is to empower the user, to help library users become independent and independent learners, but at the same time always be there as a support system. Libraries changing constantly.
Oh, yes.
One of the things that I was fortunate to have kind of adopted a librarian, a good friend of mine who was a major influence on a number of private school librarians, a woman named Pauline Anderson, who was the library director at Choate Rosemary Hall. Pauline made me aware early on that everything always seemed to get smaller. And that certainly is true. I was thinking the other day of my first exposure to computers and computing was at the Rutgers University computer, which occupied the space of a gymnasium. That was the one computer. And now computing power greater than that is on our cell phones, something we carry around with us. And that's true whenever we were planning facilities. One of the things that I always had to try and get people not to do was not to build spaces that were permanently assigned a certain task, a certain job, like a listening room, for example, unless it could easily be adapted to something else. Because listening used to be, you would sit at a table and you would plug your headphones in and you would put a disc on, or then later on a reel-to-reel tape, mm-hmm. or all of these different tools, and you'd be stuck. You'd be tethered to that machine in order to listen to whatever it is you're trying to listen. Mm-hmm. And when we had one of those rooms that was became associated with the library, I took it over from the music department. It was adjacent to the library, and one of the things that we did as soon as the technology became available was buy cassette recorders and cassette players so that people could take a cassette and go and listen to it any place they could find a plug. They had to have a power outlet.
Yeah.
Which was
We've now moved to the voice recorder that doesn't need an outlet.
Exactly. And those kinds of things were certainly an important important thing to remember. But there are those kinds of little rules of the road that you pick up, and over the years, you make some mistakes. Fortunately,
we're human.
I chose VHS over. I can't remember the alternative, but at the time there were two things, and everyone was saying, you're making the wrong decision, but VHS turned to be kind of what everyone did, the popular standard. I don't think so. I've had an extraordinary career. I had tremendous support. I loved every minute of what I was doing. I never regretted the decisions I made to either become a librarian or to become the director of the library at Hotchkiss. It was always a very fulfilling experience for me.
What a wonderful thing it is.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time and your knowledge, and I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.